Hello and welcome back to Lower Decks, a Star Trek Discovery podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman, still a little groggy this morning after too much savory protein in carbohydrate shells last night.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland, and I don't know, Glenn, just like you, my semester is about to wrap up, but I would really like the option to just jump 930 years in the future right about now.
Yes, well, I think we're both gravitating towards this future where we live on Discovery and Zora is our best friend. I think we both just want to live in the Calypso episode right now. Like, I don't know if AI computer systems need drinks, but I will happily run a speakeasy in the Jeffrey's Tubes with you, even if we are our own only customers.
I feel like Zora would be into that. I don't know if Zora, you know, loves movies, but she likes to project herself into them. So why not this?
I could totally see myself in the Tom Cruise role in Cocktail. So if Zora wants to hook us up with that, yeah, I think that'd be fun. I think I could live alone on a spaceship if that's going to be my lot in life.
I think that living alone on a spaceship will drive you to that being your lot in life.
Yeah, pretending to be Tom Cruise. Look, I'm practically there already.
Well, today we are wrapping up Discovery's second season. It is finally time for us to talk about all the things we kept talking about, not talking about, on last week's finale episode.
Yes, exactly. I'm very excited to get into this episode. But before we get into that, I do want to thank all of our new Patreon supporters. We were trying really hard to get to this goal of being able to host an online hangout with people to talk about this season of Discovery all together. We came very, very close. And even though we didn't make that goal, it's great to have so many new supporters who are going to keep hanging out with us during the hiatus as we go and cover non-Discovery Star Trek over on Patreon. All right, well, what are we doing today? What are we actually doing in this wrap-up episode? So to start, we're going to offer just a kind of broad assessment of this season. Then we're going to talk about our favorite episodes, favorite scenes, least favorite episodes as well. And then we're going to give out some awards. I'm going to play Smooch, Marry, Kill. Following that, we're going to get into the character arcs of this season. Then we're going to talk about some themes. And then finally, that is actually where we will get into all the things we weren't talking about during the finale. That's speculations and predictions for the future. And then finally, at the end, we're going to have a cocktail from Valerie. And that'll be the wrap-up episode. So, Valerie, just to get us started, let's jump right into the assessment portion here. Here's what I want to know. How did you think season two of Discovery compared to season one? Which did you like better?
Oh my gosh, that's actually a very difficult question because I think I've been divided in different ways across both seasons. Season one, it's hard to compete with that we have new Trek on the air and just the excitement of that and going on the journey of what do the uniforms look like? Who are these people? Oh, look, the Klingons are new. Like, there was just something often quite respectful, I thought, to the canon, though I know a lot of people disagree, but there were just an attention to detail I felt from the showrunners a lot of times in season one that maybe filtered through that excitement I really, really enjoyed. And also, you know, I had some problems with the darkness of the show and its pace and the violence and kind of the serial nature of the show. But I think I'm going to have to give it to season two, actually, because it just had more fun. I have a lot of issues with season two. Listeners have heard them before. They're going to hear them again today. You're welcome. But season two, I thought, inched closer to that fun, campy, episodic humor that I love from Trek. What about you?
If I had to place a bet on which season you were going to like better and why, that's exactly what I would have picked. I think what you gravitated to here in season two of Discovery were kind of the moments of season two TOS, where we get some of the classic humor episodes like Trouble with the Tribbles and so on. In fact, Gene Roddenberry famously very annoyed that in his absence doing other projects, Gene Kuhn had made the show funny on him. But you like that. That's what you really gravitate towards. For me, I liked season one better because the things that I'm looking for in Trek weren't particularly here. And in thinking about this, I was really going through the sort of 30-ish seasons of Star Trek that we have and was playing in my mind a kind of game of Survivor with them, which actually would make a great series of Patreon episodes, so we might be doing those soon. And I think this season of Discovery would rank pretty near the bottom for me. I don't know that it would be the first one I would kick off my space island, but, you know, it would be maybe in the first five that I would kick off, I think. And that was really unexpected for me. Where we left off season one, and especially even where we go in the first episode of season two, I had high expectations that I was going to get the type of science fiction story that I really wanted, get the things I go to Trek for, and I didn't. And so for me, disappointment is really the key word this season. I've used it a lot already. I'm going to use it a lot again here today. And for me, those the things I was disappointed in, or the real weaknesses of this season for me, are the lack of strong philosophical questions, philosophical themes, and really no social commentary really at all in this season. The found family camaraderie, which is something that always draws me to Trek and other ensemble shows too, that was here, but it was spotty. It was not nearly as strong as we get in other Treks. And these are my primary values, right? These are the things that I go to. They're my primary values, but they do not seem to be the writer's primary interests. But even with that level of disappointment that I had, this season still did some things really well. There were really awesome elements of this season. Pike and the Enterprise, I mean, I would just have that all day. I mean, totally worth it. Just absolutely awesome. The Spock Burnham story was not my favorite part of the season. It wasn't something that draws me to the show, but it's done really well. And there are a lot of people, a lot of our listeners and forum contributors for whom that is their primary interest in the show. It's nailed. I think it's done extraordinarily awesomely here. And of course, the production values. I mean, there is no Trek that looks and sounds better than Discovery. So it is just a joy to look at and to listen to all the time, even if I'm disappointed that I'm not getting social commentary and philosophical themes and so on.
Yeah, none of this surprises me from the discussions that we've had on air and off air, and even just, you know, the years long battle we've been having about how you think Deep Space Nine is the best show on air. This makes sense. It's the least funny. It's right. The least campy of all the shows. And I've come to have a deeper appreciation for that show than I did when I first started watching it, and I found it really difficult to get into. And then the fact that, like, for some reason I really, really love Enterprise, like, can tell you a lot about what I'm looking for in Trek. But, you know, I also feel that those philosophical and moral themes and the social commentary are absent to a degree that I am dissatisfied with in both season one and season two. And so I kind of see it almost as a level playing field. And given that, season two was at least more fun and I got to hang out with Pike. I feel like Pike really does redeem the show. I did want to make a comment, though, that while I do agree that we're missing a lot of social commentary in Star Trek Discovery in general, I really do think that casting choices are a very big part of the commentary that this show is giving us. The visual representation of who we are looking at on screen, what they look like, whether, you know, that's ethnicity or size or alienness, that is quite remarkable in Discovery. And then, of course, you know, we would be remiss not to mention, like, who you're in a relationship with, right? Those kinds of decisions, like with Colburn Stamets and with Jet. And I don't think we get her wife's name, but she's a Soyuzian, if I recall correctly.
That's right. You still don't know who that is, what that means, but I'm excited to find out someday.
Right. And so if you think about the power of seeing somebody that looks like you in a leading role or in a role at all on a show like this, where you've never seen somebody that looks like you in this kind of a show before, that is really powerful. I don't think it's licensed to ignore the other kinds of things we want Trek to give us, but I do think it needs to be celebrated because it's pretty remarkable on Discovery.
It is. I think it's hard for us to put ourselves back in the mindset of the mid-1960s to really read TOS along those lines as well, but my sense anyway here in 2019 is that Discovery is perhaps the best example of trying to pave new ground simply through the act of representation on the screen. I think it even goes a step further than TOS did, and we absolutely should applaud them for that. I have some more comments about the difference between the way that themes and social commentary are handled between season one and season two. But hey, we've got a whole section on themes here in the second half of the show. We can save the rest of that for that point. And I think we can move now into talking about our favorite episodes and favorite scenes. Valerie, I'm going to let you have the first crack at this. What was your favorite episode this season?
This was tough, Glenn, because, you know, in reviewing the episodes, I really noticed that every episode had things that I really liked and then things that I felt really frustrated by. So it was, it, I think, you know, favorite scenes or favorite moments or favorite storylines is a more approachable way to get through this season. But if I have to pick, I'm picking New Eden. And I had a couple runners up here. My runner up, my big runner up was The Sound of Thunder, because we meet the metal Baul. And I know I complained a lot about the Baul, but they were still pretty cool. I would go to that metal show. And I love kind of anything Kelpian and all things Kaminar. So that was a beautiful episode for me. But the reason I settled on New Eden was because this is right off the bat in the beginning of the show when I think the beginning of season two had the most momentum and promise of fun and whimsy and kind of traditional Trek. And the second episode they give us is an away team episode. And I'd been saying more away team episodes, please, all through season one. So I was like, oh my God, they listened to me. They're giving me this. This is so fun. And, you know, there was lots of Awoshakun in that episode. So I was not upset about it. And I know you had a lot of complaints that Burnham was kind of ruining everything and super bad at being undercover. but I kind of thought that was fun. That kind of stuff happens in Trek all the time. That's why I picked New Eden.
Well, like you, I gravitated towards the beginning of the season, and I'm picking the first episode, Brother. This is one I really loved. For me, this is a top 10, probably not top 10 episodes of Trek, but a top 10% of Trek. This is probably even my single favorite episode of all of Discovery. I just adored our first interactions with Pike, our first glimpses of the Enterprise. Hearing Ethan Peck as Spock there was just awesome. Even meeting creepy child Spock was something I really enjoyed. I loved all of the elements that are woven into that. We get the great prologue opening with Burnham narrating about what the stars have meant for different cultures on Earth, non-spacefaring cultures on Earth, but that's all also wrapped up in images that we see of the Cassini mission and so on. And I loved the way that Discovery in that first episode was saying, hey, humans have had a relationship with outer space since, you know, the dawn of time, and we're just a part of that. And this is a story about that. And really, that leads me into the second thing that I loved about Brother was the promise of the premise in these seven signals and exploring what space is, why we're so drawn to it, what our connections are. The resolution of this turned out to be a massive disappointment that really hangs over how I feel about later episodes. But here at the beginning, my heart was just pounding out of my chest with excitement. I watched this again before we came in to record this morning and still have that same feeling, even though I know that I'm not going to like the way the story ends. I still think it's fantastic.
What I'm hearing you say is that you picked Brother because it's the episode where we first meet Jet Reno.
Sure, there's that too. She's fine.
Now you're giving me a lot of nostalgia for this episode that I will say there were definitely things about Brother that I didn't like. I didn't like the creepy child Spock thing. And I know that that's a bit of a controversial opinion, especially, from being in dialogue with listeners on our forums and for how this journey comes. I just thought that, I don't know, something about the aesthetic of child Spock just didn't read as intriguing to me, and was a little bit off-putting instead. So something didn't quite resonate there. But, you know, thinking of that, I'd forgotten how they really intersplice the Cassini images and how cool that is, and makes me think of Enterprise and the ridiculous intro that we get. And like, yes, it's ridiculous. Yes, the song is ridiculous, but I think the point is kind of the same. Like, look at our interest in space, and here's a story about us trying to figure that out. And so that had a lot of nostalgia for me as well. And I know you hate New Eden, but I still pick New Eden because, like, we don't really know Pike that well in episode one. Like, I feel like New Eden, we get some solid Anson Mount time.
Yeah, he basically jumps on a grenade in that episode, and then we get to see him in that sweater. Anson Mount sweater's kind of a thing for me. It's a new discovery of my own this season.
All right, well, we did it. We kicked this off with some intense positivity, but I think it must be done. We must declare our least favorite episodes. And Glenn, I'm going to make you start, though I think I'm almost going to have to hold you back here.
Well, I'm going to bookend the season here, and I'm going to pick the finale, Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2, as my least favorite episode of the season. There were, I think, a lot of bad episodes this season, unfortunately, but the flaws in those episodes, I think, all appear again in the finale, all kind of jumbled together into a real mess of an episode. I won't list all of those flaws here because we're going to get into them in other parts of the episode today, but I will say a few things about why I chose this one here in this category. The complete disregard for our characters, the heroes of Discovery, of the TV show, in favor of focusing on new characters like Poe and Serana, just didn't make any sense to me, and it didn't resonate with me, and it actually felt kind of offensive. It was as if the showrunners were saying, we know you care about these characters that the previous showrunners invented, but, well, we're here now, and frankly, we don't like those characters very much and wish we were telling stories about these types of people instead. And I felt a little bit like I was being insulted for caring about those characters. The battle was all style with no substance. In Trek, our heroes are supposed to win by being smarter and nobler than the baddies. There are some brief nods to this here, but none of it had any immediate consequence. It was just flashy, just style over substance. And of course, there were massive plot holes in there. We've talked about some of those already when we reviewed that episode. And there's going to be more on this in the next segment, because this is going to be one of our award categories as well.
While I did not pick this episode as my least favorite, I get your points. I think they're incredibly valid. I think style over substance, which now it just sounds like we're judging the Great British Bake Off, is a criticism that I would launch about the show in general, but particularly the last episode of the finale. And I found myself feeling similarly. Though, again, I do appreciate that we get Jet Reno back. I feel like they needed to have more evenly distributed her across the season, so I wouldn't always have that caveat.
And presumably, we can look forward to more of her in season 3, but more on that later. I think now it is your turn to be on the spot here, Valerie. What was your least favorite episode?
I'm going to surprise no one and say my least favorite episode was Perpetual Infinity, episode 11, the Cranky Pants episode.
Right, yes, that's the subtitle. That's the official Lower Deck subtitle for that episode.
I did have a runner-up, which I think will maybe surprise people, that my runner-up least favorite was Saints of Imperfection, which is our journey through the mycelial network with Tilly. I don't know if that surprises you that I didn't feel super strongly about that episode.
I didn't feel super strongly about that episode either. And in fact, now that we've gotten all the way through the season, I'm not really sure what that whole story arc was really for, other than to maybe fill out episodes and explain why they rehired Wilson Cruz after they killed off his character in season 1.
Yeah, I think there was a lot to like, and this is one of my biggest criticisms of this season, is that there is always something awesome happening, or multiple awesome things happening in any given episode, and then the season leaves it. It drops it. It doesn't follow it through. It offers this promise, like you were talking about in Brother, of something pretty wonderful, and then we don't totally get it. So in Saints of Imperfection, even though it was my runner-up least favorite, we see Tilly kind of be in command, and that's a cool tie-in to her whole narrative, her command narrative from season 1 that kind of gets dropped in the rest of season 2. And of course, we get Culber back. I just didn't think the whole thing was done, and May was a bit rough for me as a character. But I actually picked Perpetual Infinity. I don't think I need to remind anyone why I don't like this episode. So I will say that Dr. Burnham is flip-floppy. Leland was crazy pants with the bazooka. And it wasn't my favorite, though I did appreciate that this is the moment, brief as it was, where Tyler does something right. He does something ethical. And then he's going to stop doing that immediately and become the head of Section 31. But it felt like it was a potential turning point in his character arc that didn't come to pass. But I'll give Perpetual Infinity something nice.
Perpetual Infinity also has Ash Tyler's Chevy Chase-style pratfall of a overacted death, which may be, at least certainly for me, was a strong contender for favorite scene of the season, which is where we are now. But Valerie, you get to have first crack at this one as well.
I'm slow clapping over here as you mentioned that scene, and I'm a little bit upset that I didn't pick it, because, yeah, it's the obvious choice for my favorite. So, you know, let's keep in mind that my favorite scene pick is limited by my memory.
There's still time. You can claim it now.
No, I think I'm not going to claim it. I think I'm just decided that, Glenn, you are very interested in all my runners up, and I think you're not doing this, but I'm going to keep going. So my runner up was Pike touching the time crystal. That scene was amazing. And, you know, the speech that we get from Pike was everything that we want Starfleet to be. But I picked Culber and Ash Tyler / Voak fighting.
Well, I don't think you're alone in that one. It wasn't mine, but I think there are other people who really enjoyed that too. But I have to ask, is your investment in this scene about two very handsome men locked in combat, or is it about the emotion of the scene between these characters, or all of the above?
All of the above, obviously. You can't, you know, really parse one out from the other, but mostly the emotion. I thought there were so many really wonderful things about this scene. So this was a fight scene that like wasn't overly violent, but that was important to the story in myriad ways and fun to watch. So it had that style and substance thing going on. And it wasn't some giant overdone CGI space battle. It was, you know, our characters all in one spot working some stuff out. So I really loved that aspect of the action of the sequence. But there was so much going on. We have Saru for the first time kind of like defying orders or doing something that's a little bit questionable. And that was such a cool moment in his narrative over the season. And then again, there was a promise here that something might be done with how incredibly interesting it is that Culber is back from the dead. He has this dual identity because he's literally this rebirthed, remade person. And we have this whole Tyler Voke, we don't even know what to call him problem, right? And he's got this duality to his identity. And, you know, the intrigue of the murder that was also getting resolved and the emotions coming out. And I really thought that it was going to be a bigger moment for catharsis. Catharsis not just in that I punched you and now I feel better, but we're going to sit down and talk about that we actually are the only two people that could best understand what the other one is going through and where can we take this. Again, I feel like they completely dropped that and I really, really wish they hadn't, but there was so much promise in that scene and I really loved it.
There was. And unfortunately, yeah, this is the last that we really get of that. That's something I think we definitely missed out on this season. Well, my favorite scene also takes place in the mess hall. So I think what we're saying here universally is more mess hall scenes, please. I'm picking the mess hall scene in Project Daedalus. It's Arium's memory where she is just having a meal with her friends and they're talking about playing Catascot, right? And this, of course, just calls to mind immediately the poker game from The Next Generation, which actually happens way less frequently than we all remember it happening, but is such a strong element of that show. Again, found family, the camaraderie of serving together. These are things that I go to Star Trek for. I want more moments like this. So this was my single favorite scene this season. Well, Valerie, are you ready to give out some awards?
They're not called awards. Glenn, I would really appreciate it if you called them by their real name.
All right, then let's jump right into our first category. And that category is Best Ship. So which ship gets the Valerie for being awesome this season?
Now I'm just sad again that you have a better award name because my name already has the E in it. So listeners were supposed to solve this for us last year, but I don't think anything.
I thought this was the solution.
Yeah, probably.
It was.
But the Valerie for best ship, I think last season I said it was the space whale. So yes. I think you know that you're not going to get something very traditional from me. And it was super hard not to say the Enterprise for all of the reasons. But my Valerie for best ship goes to the squid probe from the future.
So what I hear you saying is that I should get you one of these for your next birthday.
Yeah, man. That thing is so cool. I really, really genuinely loved the whimsy of we sent in this probe and then it came back like alive, you know, and is trying to attack us. I thought that was really fun. And I thought it looked really cool. And it was very dynamic, you know, it was interacting. And, you know, I'm not hearing you say thank you for calling it a squid.
I forgot that was actually my name for it and not the official designation. No, it's a great choice. That's a very fine choice. It is not the ship I am giving the Glennie to, however. I mean, it has to be the Enterprise, right? Come on, one of us has to say it at least. Look, the Enterprise is, of course, a ship that we all feel emotionally attached to before we even come to Discovery. But also, it just looked awesome. I mean, the crew responsible for putting those sets together and for making the external shots, the CGI Enterprise, they deserve a big standing ovation from all of us. But especially, gosh, that bridge just looked perfect. It was seamlessly inserted into the aesthetic of this new show, but also was an amazing homage to the 60s. Just awesome.
And actually, one of my favorite parts of the season finale, Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2, was at the very end where we see the Enterprise warp away. And the design of the nacelles on Enterprise is just gorgeous to look at. It, you really feel like you know what you're looking at. It's the Enterprise. You're not upset. They didn't mess it up. And you're excited because they really did update it and give it a modern look. And I can't even imagine how difficult it is to strike that balance. But now that we have talked about the ships, let's talk about who is on them and get into our next Glennie Valerie category, which is best hair.
Last year, we gave out this award as well, and we thought for sure we were going to have the same answer. And so we counted down and shouted them simultaneously, and then they turned out to be different answers. But I think we need to try this again this year. So, Valerie, why don't you count us down, and we'll see if we're on the same page this time.
3, 2, 1. Supposed Nuke Anglia.
Wait, that's not even hair.
That's totally hair adjacent.
No, it's literally called ganglia, which is not the same thing as hair.
It's Kelpian hair, and it's offensive for you to say that it's not the same.
I suppose Kelpians, by virtue of not having hair, or seeming at least not to have hair, perhaps are disqualified from this. No.
I think it's a haircut. His old ganglia, they cut him off, and he grew out a new style. And this time it shoots spikes.
And he does look great with it, too, right? He's carrying himself better. He's got real confidence and real swagger now that he's got this new haircut, I guess we're calling it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Of course, runners-up, OO, always and forever with best haircut. Michael's haircut does not get enough love. It's a very good haircut. And then, of course, Tyler's beard.
That was my runner-up, was Tyler's beard. I had real beard envy from him this season.
Well, Glenn, I have a secret subcategory here. It's worst hair. I think we need to give an award for worst hair. And it's mostly just so that I can give my answer. But I'll give you a second to think about it if you need it. But while you're thinking, my Valerie for worst hair goes to Spock.
Is it the actual hair or is it the beard?
It's all of it. It's all of it. I complain about that one Vulcan haircut, but I guess I really like it. And I don't know. I think I'm mad about how attractive Ethan Peck is and how much they hid it under a bunch of hair all season.
I actually quite liked Spock's beard, and I also liked the haircut that he had. And in fact, I'm going to give the Glennie for worst hair to Spock, who we see in the coda at the very end of the season when he is looking very much like Leonard Nimoy. I loved that he looked exactly like Leonard Nimoy, but I thought, ooh, Ethan Peck looked a lot better when he was doing his Marlboro Man routine.
Oh, man, you're just trying to make me upset. My mouth was agape the entire time you were speaking. I'm very upset about it. And I will pretend to respect your opinion.
Well, I'm going to quickly get us into the next award so that perhaps you'll forget that I've been such a jerk to you. Next award is Best Monologue. I'm going to take first crack at this one. I am picking Laurel's mother speech from episode 3, this political speech in which she proclaims she is going to be the mother of the Klingons because Ash Tyler had murdered her baby. I missed all of the Klingon speeches that we had gotten from season 1, especially the T'Kuvma speeches in particular were speeches that I just loved. It was great to get this sort of thing again. Klingons are always giving great speeches in these audience halls where people are like pounding their fists on stuff and just chanting and shouting in Klingon. I'm always a sucker for that type of scene. So that gets the Glennie.
I appreciate you bringing that back. The Klingon storyline really got lost in this season. Most storylines really got lost in this season. I guess yeah. You can just say that and then stop saying it. But that was a really powerful scene. And it was cool to relive it kind of through your answer.
Well, who's going to get the Valerie for this one?
I think the most obvious answer, which I'm not going to give, is, you know, Pike's monologue to himself, Pike's speech to himself in through the Valley of Shadows, which was one of my contenders for favorite episode, actually. But I think I'm going to pick Saru's monologue to Tilly about self-care in sickbay, about how we have to care for ourselves before we can care for others. And we need to rest and relax and not escape from sickbay. Tilly, stop.
Well, I think both of the contenders that you had there, and I'll say Pike's speech as well and was my runner-up. You've gravitated towards thinking about speeches that are actually useful and solid advice for us in our lives. Laurel's speech hopefully is not one I will ever have to be modeling a speech on.
Don't act like you didn't say it all to me this morning.
Yes, true. Oh, I would definitely love to be the chancellor of the Klingon Empire. Maybe if we can get our hands on some time crystals, we can make that happen for me.
Before we move on from best monologue, I have to give a special shout out, Valerie, to best duet on the show for Tilly and Stamets' rendition of some Bowie. I know that's a controversial opinion. I know a lot of people didn't like it. I loved it. It was touching. It was moving. It was Bowie. I think that's enough said.
I love this award category, and I'm just going to break all the rules and say, no, the best group sing-along is obviously Spock, Bones, and Kirk at the beginning of Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. So I'm just giving it to them. I know they're not in this show. But
some of them are in this show. Yeah,
enough of them are in the show, I think, for it to qualify. So I'm giving that the Glennie. Along the same lines as monologue and singing along, I think it is time now to give out the award for best single line, or maybe best quip might be the better way of thinking about this. Who's getting the Valerie for this one?
Oh, this was tough. I think that the best set of quips for me was the brief scene of Tyler and Laurel arguing in front of Pike about whether or not Pike gets to know that they have a secret baby on Boreth. it's not too quippy. It's just so fun, the bickering that happens. And it brings a lot of love for those two characters and where their relationship is now. And it's in Klingon, so that's really neat. But I feel like this is kind of a cop-out, but I think my favorite line or my best quip is Pike saying hit it. And Pike saying hit it the first time, because I think he doesn't do it as well in the finale, I have to say.
I am so surprised that Jet Reno is not winning this award.
I know.
You.
I think I have. I don't know. I mean, yes, right? Like an armistice, what with the guys that drink blood wine? Like there were a lot of good. There was a lot of good fodder there. But I just, the joy that I experienced when Pike sat in that chair, looked at me directly in the eyes, because it's all about me, and said, "Hit it." I mean, everyone should aspire to have that much confidence and cool nonchalance.
I'm not giving the award to Jet Reno either, but a strong contender, the kind of runner-up for me, was her line about being smart and being able to read books in order to give medical treatment to all of these people, even though she's an engineer and not a doctor. But I have to give the Glennie to Tilly. Somebody does definitely owe her a beer. Also, I would love to have a beer with Tilly. So there's that.
Tilly did have a lot of great lines. Yeah, like somebody owes me a beer, but also anything's more fun if you put time in front of it, right? She had a lot of fun lines. I think the comedic relief of the Tilly character could have been used to better effect throughout this season, but they were trying with it, and I did enjoy it. And we don't have to create a category for this. I just cannot get away without saying that the Valerie for worst quip or worst line goes to Giorgio's pansexual rant. People know how I feel about it, but I felt like they needed to hear it again.
Oh, I think you have completely forgotten another quip not issued by Giorgio, but Giorgio adjacent, and that is yum yum, which I think has to get the award for worst quip. Certainly gets the award for most morally flawed and highly problematic aspect of this entire show.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. I might switch my Valerie to the Glennie answer for worst quip. But that means we have one award category left, which is best plot hole.
Right. This is another listener suggested category from last year. And I think even last year we talked about what exactly constitutes a plot hole, and also needed to emphasize that by best, we definitely mean worst, right? The biggest sort of plot problem that we had is sort of how we're interpreting this one. I'm going to go first on this. I'm going to give the Glennie to the arrival of the Allies in Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2. We've talked already about the problem with Tyler being on that Klingon ship. We spent a lot of time on that in our last episode. But the reason that Tyler had to be physically present on that ship in the first place, such that people are seeing that he's not actually dead, is that the comms are jammed and Discovery and Enterprise can't call for help. So he has to physically go find them. But this is a journey that should take months because they're deep in Federation space. And so if you're leaving to go get help, why not just go get some Federation help since you're actually within Federation territory? And also, it's maybe more okay for them to know you're not actually dead. Also, why didn't Sarek do this? Why didn't he bring allies? And we also have the same problem here with Serana's arrival as well, because she says that she came because she got Saru's farewell letter, but because of the jamming, he could not actually have sent that letter. So the whole reason Tyler has to go, it can't be true if Serana is there. So that's all messed up. Also, I hate the whole business with destabilizing Kaminar and just pretending that everything got worked out there in a matter of weeks. This, to me, is almost everything I complain about through the whole season wrapped up in 10 seconds of screen time right there.
I can tell you have some feelings about it. So I think that I do want to say that an important runner-up here for me that we did not give a lot of time on air to was, why does Control really need the sphere data? Like, I feel like that's a question that... they don't muck with it too much. They never give us a contradiction, so it's harder to see the plot hole. But I just don't totally understand how Control isn't intelligent enough already. What is it really missing with this sphere data? That's something I would really like answered. But I am going to have to go with the unproblematic reappearance of Ash Voke in front of other Klingons. And I was going back and doing a little bit of a rewatch. It is in episode 14, the season finale, that we get Ash on a ship with other Klingons who are still professing their loyalty to the Mother Chancellor, remembering that she would not be the Mother Chancellor if it weren't for this guy supposedly murdering her baby. So, like, you would think... you might rethink that name or something. But it is only two episodes before that in Through the Valley of Shadows, during the argument that I was just saying I loved between Tyler and Laurel that happens in front of Pike, where Laurel says, you can't do that because for Klingons to know that you are still alive would leave me vulnerable to sedition. It gets a big chunk of screen time on air that this is still a thing. It's not like a thing we left early on in the season and then forgot about at the end. It was two episodes ago and clearly stated. And then now it just doesn't matter.
Well, I'm glad we're basically giving the award to the same thing. This whole arrival of allies, this kind of deus ex machina, this the Eagles are coming moment here in the finale is problematic for all of these plot hole reasons. But also, if we didn't have that be the thing that's going to save the day and buy a little more time, we also could have found a way for Admiral Cornwell to have something to do, some decision she's making, some sacrifice she's making is actually what saves the day and buys that time, which would have given her death more immediate consequence, more meaning. So this choice that the writers made here, I think, is consequential in some really negative ways. I don't know why we're not working in the writers' room, you know?
It was still fun for me when the ship showed up.
It did look cool. And that's what they went for. I think that might be the problem, though.
Well, all right. So let's leave that negativity behind. Leave those plot holes behind in the past, which is where they will safely sit for season 3 of Star Trek Discovery and do some smooching. And for this smooch, Mary Kill, we're going to impose a new rule, which is, Glenn, you are not allowed to kill a villain. You can't kill a bad guy.
Yeah, that's just the low-hanging fruit. And of course, my impulse is to kill Leland. Again, just because of the nanobots thing creeps me out. I'm on record already with that. But I will accept your parameters here. And I'm going to start with who I want to smooch. It has to be Pike. Look, it could just be Pike's hair, frankly. It doesn't even have to be all of Pike. I would like to marry Pike, but I know he has this one true love. I don't want to get in the way of that. And I know that he would just never feel about me the same way I feel about him. So just going to smooch, you know, we'll enjoy that fleeting moment while it lasts. But then I am going to turn around and marry number one.
What betrayal to your smooch to go to the next in command.
Yeah, I guess I really wasn't thinking about it in those terms. It is just that number one is extremely clever. She's definitely in charge around here. And of course, hamburger and habanero sauce. I just can't say no to that. Someday, though, we are going to have to do a smooch marry kill for me that pits number one against Hoshi. That's going to be a tough choice for me.
It is such an easy choice. Why? This thing with Hoshi, man, I'll never get it. But okay, we have a good guy to get rid of.
Yes. I don't know if this person's going to constitute as a good guy, but I'm going to kill Dr. Burnham. She was not a villain, but she was a jerk to everyone in that scene. I know it was kind of part of her character arc that she's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Not even post. It's just traumatic stress disorder. She's still in it, trying to save the world single-handedly. We don't know how many times she has already witnessed this. Nonetheless, I thought she could have been a little bit nicer. You know, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. But also, I think she's just made some real mistakes to begin with, right? The reason she's in this position to start with is that she's made mistakes. Look, if we kill her, then the whole story doesn't have to happen at all. And our characters could just have happy existences. And I'm all in favor of that.
Oh, wow. If we kill Dr. Burnham, the whole story doesn't have to happen at all. Wow. Talk about a season two wrap up, Glenn.
Well, I didn't mean because I didn't enjoy the story. I meant that because then our characters wouldn't have to go through all of this. Think of all the characters, unnamed people who died in that final battle and so on. That's who I'm concerned about here.
Well, I think this is a little harsh. I'm gonna disagree with this kill. You know, I think she just needs time and to be around people again. It's been a long time. Well, with our final smooch marry kill of the season complete, that's about the halfway mark in what we want to talk about with you guys today. So it seems like a good time to take a break before we get into the seriousness of all those themes and character arcs in the second half of the show and let everybody know what we're going to be covering over on Patreon during the Discovery hiatus.
I'm really excited about what we've decided to do during the hiatus. We don't quite know how long that hiatus will actually be, but I think we can predict that it's going to be about a year, possibly a little less, but also possibly a little longer. This is all going to depend on when the Picard show is going to air. So far, we've been told late 2019, but you know that could be December 31st. I think they're going to want to not let the holidays interrupt this and so on. So unless we meet our Patreon goal of coming back to cover that Picard show, this could be a year or so that we're on hiatus. So we know that for sure we're going to cover quite a bit of Deep Space Nine and also Voyager. Deep Space Nine in particular is a show that we've not actually covered much on Patreon. So I'm excited to get some more of that under our belt. But the first thing that we are going to do, and we're going to be doing this very shortly, is recording a discussion of the Enterprise episode Similitude. This is a great one about the ethics of cloning, how we decide who is a person and who isn't. It's one of my favorites, favorite of all Trek. It's probably hands down my single favorite episode of Enterprise. I've been wanting to do this one for a long time. Very excited for this.
Right. And with Deep Space Nine, there's so much to talk about there, particularly in the last couple seasons, about themes of religion and lack thereof and different types of spirituality and the role that religion plays. And we've talked a little bit about Sisko and his resistance to being the emissary being quite similar to some of the themes we've seen here in season two of Discovery. So it's all going to tie in. So while we are covering all that for you, we hope that you will continue to join us, that you will join us on Patreon, that you will join us in enjoying revisiting these episodes and keeping our Trek community active during the hiatus.
Yeah, talking about these episodes with people on the forum or over on our Patreon forum as well is one of the real joys of doing the show. So very much looking forward to that. I mean, we're going to enjoy the hiatus, right? We're excited to come back for season three, but it is also so awesome to revisit these older episodes. But I think now it is time for us to transition into, as you put it, Valerie, the more serious elements of our breakdown, our wrap-up of the season. We're going to talk about the character arcs first, then we're going to get into the themes here, and then we'll get into those predictions and speculations. I think the first character we've got to talk about is Spock. And I think probably the natural thing to do here is to talk about this from the perspective of how did Spock live up to our expectations, to what we bring with us from that character, from TOS, even from TNG, and also even from the Abrams verse, the J.J. Abrams films, or the Kelvin verse is what we're officially calling it now. So let's talk about Spock. Let's talk about Ethan Peck's portrayal of Spock. How did you feel about it?
So in terms of, you know, how Spock lived up to what I expected or wanted him to be in this season, it's such a complicated answer because I think I didn't want Spock. I didn't want it. I was very resistant to the idea of it. I didn't think it was necessary. I'm one of these people who just really wanted Discovery to be set past Deep Space Nine, past Voyager, you know, into the future, which kind of going to get. So that's a bit of a spoiler for what I'm going to say about season three coming up. But for someone who was really afraid they were going to mess it up, Spock is probably my favorite Trek character of all time. He's always my Mary when we play Smooch, Mary, Kill with Kirk, Spock, Bones. and Glenn never agrees with me, but I know I'm right. I didn't want them to touch it, but I felt they did it really respectfully. I think that if they had to do it, they did it really well. They did not muck it up. And I don't know. I want to be really grateful for that. And also, I'm still a little frustrated that it had to happen at all. So I'm still working it out.
Yeah, I'd like to probe into that answer a little bit more. And well, really, I should probably say I'd like to squid probe into that answer a little bit more. People missed my squid jokes. Probably not at all, I think.
I missed them.
I'll try to make that the last one. Do you feel that what we have learned about Spock, what we've learned about his childhood, and maybe this is a place where we can even talk about learning that Spock had a sister. Do you think that that has enhanced your appreciation for Spock when you go back and watch original series episodes? Or do you wish they had left that alone, as so many viewers do?
Yeah, it's so funny. I think this is maybe what I was getting at, and I haven't wrapped my head all the way around it, and so I'm not going to be as articulate about it as I would like, but if I had my choice, I probably would have liked them to have left this all alone. And I still feel that way. And also, I do really genuinely think that this adds a richness to the character of Spock that makes Spock, as I know him, and as I have come to love him pre-discovery, I think enriched and more complex. I think that something that is so beautiful about the character of Spock as we know him from the original series and the films and his other appearances, you know, throughout the Trek universe, is the way in which he carries so much pain with him. And in that pain is so much emotion and so much love. And yet he has this cool, collected, calm exterior. He always gets the job done. But I think that, you know, something that was brilliantly done with his character in the original series is that while he has that cool, collected facade, it also comes through to me that this is a character with a lot of weight, that there's always something he's not saying or not feeling. And we get this built out in like Journey to Babel, and we learn the story between him and his father and kind of that pain that he carries with him. He's not cold to it, right? It's something that is with him, and he still gets his stuff done. Under the surface, he's incredibly complex and interesting, and this added more under the surface. So I can really believe that he had a sister lost to time that he is no longer allowed to talk about, and that is a pain that he carries with him. And I almost feel like I can see that pain in his performances from the 60s.
I agree completely. I think it explains so much of the way that we see his attachment to Kirk in particular. But also, I will say that all of the bratty sibling moments that we see here in Discovery between Spock and Burnham, I mean, Burnham's just a stand-in for Bones in those moments, right? We see him having that relationship again. And in fact, Burnham's final speech, as muddled as it was, it seems to be pointing not just at Kirk, but also at Bones, right? That it actually takes both of them to fill in the role that Burnham has played for him. And thinking about, I think, probably everybody's favorite Spock moment in Amok Time, when he smiles and laughs and shouts, "Jim," when he realizes that Kirk's not actually dead. Thinking that in that moment that Spock is reliving losing his sister, in part because of choices he had to make, adds such a level of depth to that, and then also makes the joy that he experiences in realizing that he hasn't lost Kirk that much greater for me. I haven't actually revisited that episode since this has happened, but I'm looking forward to it. It's going to add more to that for me. I really enjoyed that they did this choice, though, like you, that it's not the choice I would have asked for. I wasn't writing I was not part of a letter writing campaign to say more Spock, please. But now that they've done it, I'm glad that they did. I think one more thing I want to talk about with Spock before we move on to Pike is Ethan Peck's performance. And really what I want to ask you, Valerie, is we've had two actors who are not Leonard Nimoy live action take on the role of Spock, Zachary Quinto and Ethan Peck. Who do you think does it better?
Oof, that's a really rough question, especially because we spent so much more time with Ethan Peck. So I have one instinct here, which is to lean towards Quinto, because I do think that he looks more like Leonard Nimoy. And as much as I love the luscious, luscious lips of Ethan Peck, one of the defining facial features of Leonard Nimoy for me is kind of the length of his face and the thinness of his lips. And I really am surprised to see that I care strongly that the person being Spock looks a lot like Spock. It's not enough for me. And so that's why this last episode was so amazing and why it was actually really difficult for me to connect with Spock as Spock. I think for most of season 2 of Discovery, I was like, okay, this is a guy who they're telling me is Spock or something, but like, I don't really feel it. And I felt it in that final episode. So aesthetically, I think Zachary Quinto does it better. And he's got the haircut, right? And I'm pretty upset about Spock's haircut in season 2 here. But I think in terms of spirit and a quiet, thoughtful, heavy dedication that comes across on camera, spirit, dedication, thoughtfulness, respect, just in terms of what I see as a viewer, I think I have to give it to Ethan Peck. But we knew that I had this pre-existing love and dedication to Leonard Nimoy and to Spock. And you know, you're very captain-centric, I think, as a viewer. You're a Kirk fan and a Pike fan. So, Glenn, I want to know how you feel about what happened to Pike in this storyline, because Spock we know so much about and we added a little bit of backstory, but Pike was this character that was kind of a nothing character where we filled in a middle. And I'm curious just in general about your response to that in terms of story writing.
I do love Kirk. I also love Picard. And of course, those are the Star Trek characters who really, I think, shaped who I have decided to be, who I have become as an adult. Though in most other iterations of Trek, it is not the CO is the character that I most identify with or look up to or am thinking about. But Pike also has always been a character that I've been really drawn to, even in TOS, where we don't get a whole lot of him, as we've talked about a lot already this season. I was always drawn to the heroism that we see, that we learn about in the menagerie. But I also always really empathized with how much he did not want to be in a cage, which we see in the episode called The Cage, the first pilot that's not really canon, but then also recycled in The Menagerie. I feel that way too. I think that even if I were being offered this daydream existence, this hallucination existence, this virtual reality that I could live in, I think still for me, knowing that I'm a prisoner is not something that I could deal with, even if it was the fantasy life that I've always yearned for. Actually, I'm living the fantasy life I always wanted. So I don't need to go to Talos for that. And so knowing that we were going to get Captain Pike, I was a little bit nervous about what they were going to do with him. And again, in part because we've had an updated Captain Pike in the Kelvinverse, and I did not like what they did with Pike there. So I was nervous about going into Discovery, how they were going to handle that, if they were going to undermine all of these things that I admired about Pike from the original series. And they didn't. I think they greatly enhanced everything that mattered to me, knowing that Pike actually had a moment where he chose, where he's aware of this injury that's going to take away his career, the career that is his identity, that means everything to him. And he chooses that to carry out the mission. And the moment when he does that, that pep talk we've talked about already this episode, gets me every time. I'm getting goosebumps just sitting in the room now, really feeling through that choice again. I absolutely loved it. This captain is probably one of my favorite Trek captains that we've seen. Someday we'll do an actual Rank the Captains episode. I don't want to tip my hat too much. I would want to really carefully consider it, I suppose. But I loved him. I think he is someone I could look up to. I think he's a role model. And that's something I want out of my Trek captains. I want young people to look at these characters and aspire to be them and to emulate their behavior and their morality.
I didn't come into Discovery with an idea of what Pike was. I think I thought about it very differently. I was just like, who is this guy that they're, you know, grasping at straws to bring this person back? And I don't really care about Pike. So how am I going to care about this? And they pretty miraculously turned that around on me. And they also had a really hard job here, not only in kind of filling a captain's shoes at all, but in offering us a captain role model that was a character we already knew and that they cast a white guy in. And, you know, this character needed to be lovable, right? For us to say, okay, we're okay with this kind of continued stereotype of captain-esque representation, right? And they knocked it out of the park. There's I cannot find a single fault with Pike, actually, as written or performed in this entire season. But, you know, you're talking about how much it resonated with you that Pike doesn't want to be in a cage. It makes me wonder how you really do feel about the fact that kind of when he takes that time crystal, he chooses to be in a cage.
Right. And that emphasizes what a sacrifice this is for him. It's not just being injured. It's not just the disfigurement. It's that he will be trapped in some way. And I guess we're really supposed to understand that that's probably his biggest fear. But he embraces it because this is bigger than that. Yeah. And that's something that we have to admire about him.
Well, I have to ask before we close out our discussion on Pike, how can we think about him as a contrast to our season one captain? I mean, you did have a lot of feelings for Lorca that were pretty sexy feelings.
Yeah, some listener out there is saying, but wait, I thought your number one love was Lorca. Now you're saying it's Pike. You're fickle, Glenn. You are fickle.
It's not untrue.
Maybe I am. They're such contrasting characters. I think we get different things from them, and I like different things about the characters. And I don't mean that there are different things about the characters that I like. There are different things I like about the roles the characters are playing in the story. What I loved about Lorca is that he most resembled COs that I knew in the military. And so thinking about representation, to me, Lorca is the representation of service people. Whether that's soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, Lorca was a real stand-in and the real first representation that I think veterans and service people have had in Trek in some way, at least since the 60s for sure. And that was something that really resonated with me. And the dressing down that he gives to Stamets early on in season one remains one of my favorite moments in Discovery and probably one of my favorite moments in all of Trek. I'm always going to like that we got that character. Of course, it's problematic knowing that he's a baddie, you know, from the Mirror universe and so on. But I was really glad to have a character like that in the show, finally. But I think if we were doing a smooch, marry, kill with these two characters, you know, Lorca's my smooch and Pike's going to be my marry, right?
Yeah, I was kind of... I loved what you just said, and it makes so much sense for what I know of who you are, and I think it makes sense for representation in the Trek world. But I was thinking, you know, Lorca's a lot of your own history, and Pike is a lot of your own aspiration. So, you know, kudos to the show. They gave it to you in the right order.
This is an aspect of the show that I'm really grateful for. All right, so we have dealt with the original series characters who have made their way into Discovery. We got to talk about the main character, though, right? We got to talk about Michael Burnham and her journey this season, very much wrapped up with Spock and even Pike, right? This season, certainly by the end, is really the Burnham-Spock-Pike show. How did you feel about Burnham's journey this season?
I mean, do we need to talk about Burnham? Because, you know, the show talks enough about Burnham.
Yes, everything is about Burnham. The characters are kind of only around so they can talk about Burnham. At least it felt that way sort of towards the end of the season for sure.
Yeah, I think that's... I have a lot of wonderful, amazing, beautiful things to say about her, but it's clouded by the fact that the writing choices to really make her the center of everything shoved other people into the background. And that was difficult for me because there was a choice, right? Like, you can't just have infinite amounts of screen time for all of them, even though I would totally stream that Big Brother show. So it's hard for me to get over that. But that's not the fault of the character herself. I will say, though, that I don't know, maybe I miss a little bit of her growth from season one.
That's a really great point. I hadn't quite considered that. We, you know, of course, we did have so much growth from Burnham in season one. I mean, like massive amounts. But here in this season, the arc that we have from her is dealing with her past, dealing with her childhood, with her biological parents and the horrific fate that they met at the hands of these Klingons, but then also dealing with being a foster child in Sarek, in the home of Sarek and Amanda Grayson and Spock, and all of the difficulties that she found there. And the arc this season was all about healing that wound, but we don't really see her becoming more human like we did in the first season. I don't think we're done with her arc. I'm interested in what they are going to come up with, what the writers are going to come up with for her to do in the next season in terms of character growth and development and a rich emotional arc for her. I think that might actually be a tough task for them. And I wonder if we're going to de-emphasize Burnham a little bit in the next season because of that. But I think on that note, I actually want to pick up a little trail you left for us in your comment about this, Valerie, which is that because there is all this emphasis on Burnham and her relationship with Spock, and you know, something like at least 15% of the show is just flashbacks this season. Yeah, our actual Discovery characters have been shoved into the background, certainly in the last third of the season, Act 3. They're barely around at all. But I think even season-long, there are some characters who really get left behind. These are Tilly, also Culber and Stamets. In fact, all we get really of Culber and Stamets and also Tilly is this 1 3-episode arc very early in the season. And then all Tilly has to do for the rest of the season actually is provide us with quips to select for an award and doesn't really have anything to do. I love Tilly. Tilly's why I'm here. Why don't we have her?
So many people are forgotten in this way, or shoved into the background, or just like not given the opportunities to develop well. And it's really at the expense of my enjoyment of those characters. I think a classic example here is Saru. What happens to Saru? You know, I was first half of this season, all through season one, I was like, Captain Saru, Captain Saru. And by the time we get to the end, I'm like, I don't even know if I like this guy anymore, because they haven't. Now, of course, I know I love Saru. I say that flippantly, but I don't believe in him the same way that I did. I'm not invested in him in the same way that I was, because they haven't tried to make me. You know, they're not writing him that way. They let it all slide. And I think similar things happen with Tilly, though I will say that she does a little bit better than Saru. And her moment of being the one that knows the queen is pretty cool at the end of the season. So she does have that. But she suffers as well. And I know everybody knows I'm obsessed with Jet Reno, but this is a character a lot of people were super excited about, not just because Tig Notaro is delightful, not just because she's a fun bit of sarcasm, but also because she's our first lesbian character on the show. And literally, it's just like she's completely forgotten. She couldn't have walked through the background of a couple scenes for 10 episodes or I don't know. I wanted to see so much more of these other characters. I was so ready to get to know people. And nothing, I think, demonstrates this dissatisfaction more than Pike's speech about how he's really come to love the amazing personal qualities of each person on the bridge. And who cares? Because we don't know those people. It seems like Pike doesn't really either.
This is where so much of those moments near the end of the season really fell flat for me, because we're being told that all these characters have all these feelings about each other and everyone's willing to give up their whole existence, their whole lives for Burnham. And we get all these moments, but we're never actually shown very much about this. So those moments weren't earned. And it is right because these characters get shoved into the background. And I think something that you've rather brilliantly pointed out during this conversation is that we get teases of really interesting stuff going on with Saru. What happens now that he's post Vahari? We don't really see that explored, but I think we all know puberty was tough. A lot of who we are as adults is how we deal with puberty and adolescence. Let's watch Saru deal with that. I would like to watch that show. We didn't get that. Tilly and Culber and Stamets all wrapped up in going into the mycelial network, going into the underworld, which was something that we were really excited for and were also excited about when we actually got it. But then it doesn't amount to anything. It's really forgotten by the time that we get to the end. Culber comes back from the dead, has to face the person who murdered him. And as you pointed out, all we get is one fight scene, a very good fight scene, and then it's over, right? So many cues could have been taken from season 6 of Buffy the Vampire Slayer here about how to deal with a character who has come back from the dead and is struggling to fit in for a number of reasons. It's just poorly done here, but also it doesn't come back in any consequential way. And so all of these characters who are getting left behind, where it really feels disappointing is that their experiences early in the season, the first and second acts of this season, don't come back in a meaningful way to help save the day. They don't come back to resolve the plot of this season. Instead, we bring in people who are external to the story. We bring in Poe, who we've never met before, especially if you weren't able to watch the short treks, and lots of people weren't able to watch them. And we get the deus ex machina of Laurel coming back as well, instead of giving our characters something to do, our discovery characters. I think that's all a big misstep.
I know we say it a lot, but I really do think that the comparison to season 6 of Buffy is valid, because that is a story arc that they meaningfully followed throughout the entire season and that touched the character development of everyone on that show. And in season 6 of Buffy, Buffy was in heaven and she was pulled out of heaven and brought back to kind of the hell of the mortal world. Here, Colbert was kind of in hell, right? And so... What an interesting opportunity they had to see how a character would handle coming back from the dead, but, you know, coming back from such a difficult place. Mm-hmm. And we don't know how time really worked there. You can think of Angel too, when Angel was in hell and he was there for a very long time, even though it wasn't that long in the real world. So there was a lot of missed opportunity there. And I've said it before, so it doesn't need to be fully expanded here, that I would have liked Culper's journey to have been something other than just his relationship with Stamets. And if they were only going to give me the relationship with Stamets that I care about deeply, I would have liked them to have had real conversations and go through real relationship trials. And I think it is worth saying that, you know, you mentioned that the journeys of these characters should have mattered to the resolution of this plot. And I can think of a ton of times in Trek where characters go on journeys or have big things happen to them that are just like completely forgotten in the next episode. This is classic Trek, but that's kind of forgiven because it's an episodic show where you kind of start over at the beginning of the next episode. And yes, you know, TNG decides that it carries over the Picard Borg plot in a way that it doesn't carry over any of the Picard Crusher love plots from episode to episode. So choices are made. It's not always consistent, but this is something that needed more attention to it if the show was going to be a serial show with a season long arc. You cannot have those forgivable plot holes or inconsistencies with a show that's not episodic.
Well, I think we could have this conversation about characters all day. We haven't even talked about Tyler and Giorgio, but I think we can save the rest of that really for talking with people on the forum. Let's move into discussing the themes of this season. And this is probably the area where I had the most disappointment with the show. We've identified two themes that we want to talk about. The first one is time. I don't think that surprises anyone as being a theme that we would pick out. And the other is religion. But we're going to start with time. So, Valerie, my question about time here as a theme is there a message here? Is there a question that the writers want us to consider about time?
To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure that there is, in terms of how you've put the question. Like, do the writers want us to get something out of this? Do they mean for this to be coming across? Because Trek asks us the questions, right? Directly when it wants us to think about them. Trek has a scene or multiple scenes where one of the characters asks another one of the characters what you just asked me, and they talk about it on screen, and then we know what the theme is and what we're supposed to get out of that. And that is another thing that's kind of shoved in the background. So in terms of intentionality, I'm not sure that it was there. But in terms of things that I could draw from it, thinking about this show as a whole, including season one, a lot of things do come to mind. So particularly with the Spock-Burnham plotline in season two, this is about confronting the decisions we've made and be given the opportunity to right wrongs, to say we're sorry, to explain what was happening beneath the surface of something that maybe you are ashamed for having done. And this fits really nicely into the theme of second chances that is just all over season one. So I think they brought that together. And if you can play with time, if you can go back in time, literally with these flashbacks and also literally with the time suit, then you have a choice to reexamine those decisions and right those wrongs. So I think that's something that is definitely there. And what's so tragic about the Dr. Burnham character is that she is constantly trying to do this and can't ever do it. What true torture that must be to not have the ability to right the wrong or to just barely make it every time. And I think on the other side of it is the idea of imagining what our futures will be, right? Getting to go into the future, getting to think into the future. Pike gets to literally see into his future. And I think this can go in a lot of different ways. You know, as humans, I think we tend to either over idealize what a future might be or forget to think about it or plan for it altogether, or maybe just kind of unconsciously be planning for it and not realize we've attached ourselves to that plan, right? So seeing a character like Pike have to confront directly that the rest of his career is not going to play out the way he probably imagined it is an opportunity for other characters on the show to think about what they want their future to be and the role that they have in it. Again, I don't think it was really explored on the show, though. I think it's kind of all there in the background. I could draw it out. And in a couple scenes with Spock and Burnham, we get this mindfulness thing about how we have choice and we can choose what our futures are. But I would have liked more information about how is it that we, you know, how is it that our choices now matter? How is it that they change and shape the future? What's an example of doing that well and maybe doing it poorly? How could it go? I would have liked more of that.
I really appreciate how you've drawn out the way that the writers are thinking about the past as a place that we're from and has a place that has shaped us, and the possibilities for do-overs. That actually has been a pretty big theme. Second chances, do-overs across both seasons. The question of time is something that I am interested in personally outside of its appearance here in Star Trek. And in particular, I'm interested in the question of whether or not the future is set. This is not just a philosophical question. It is actually a question raised by the state of physics. A lot of our physics suggests that actually, yeah, the future is set. Time is an illusion. It's all already happened. All moments are the same moment. And if that's true, then it means that nothing we do matters. And that fills me with a lot of anxiety. And it's something I think quite a bit about. Do I have free will? Do the choices I make matter? Am I even actually making choices? Has this all been designed for some purpose? We didn't get a lot of that, but there was potential for it. We do see some of that, right, in this idea that Pike actually does have a choice. He's given a possible future and he makes that choice. I did want to know more about the physics and the cosmology of time crystals. Do we all have that? Can we go to that monastery on Boreth and there's a time crystal for us? And is that what the monks are there to do, is to safeguard that? Because that would be messing with time in some way. I would have loved an entire show that's just about time monks. And, you know, I mean, of course, yeah, everyone knows I would have loved that show. And maybe this is actually, I should just segue us into the second theme here, which is religion. Look, I was really excited in Brother and New Eden when this is presented to us as one of the central elements of the season. In fact, we get that before we get time. And I was jazzed. Jesuits in Space is my favorite type of science fiction story. These types of big philosophical and cosmological questions are really important to me, and they're really exciting to me. And I thought that we were going to get some of those explored in this season. Questions like, are we created? Do we have some purpose for some other entity, whether that's God or ancient aliens or something else entirely? Other questions too, like, is there someone out there who can see the future such that it made these signals that we would not see for tens of thousands of years? What does that mean for time as a physical property of the universe? Is the future fixed? Do we have free will? There is a ton of science fiction literature on these questions, on these topics. These are the bread and butter topics of science fiction. One contemporary writer in particular who deals with these and whose books I really quite like is Robert J. Sawyer. One book that might interest listeners is Calculating God. And Robert J. Sawyer has been involved in Star Trek before. He's not written Star Trek novels, but he's been involved in some other book projects about Star Trek. He's appeared in Trek documentaries. And Trek creators, Brandon Braga and some other people, have adapted Robert J. Sawyer novels for screen. Flash Forward is one, and there have actually been some others. So there's a relationship there. On top of that, hey, he lives in Toronto. So when we got this, when we saw this theme introduced in Brother, I immediately was on the internet looking like, is Sawyer involved in this season? Because this would be amazing to me. And sadly, he was not. And, you know, in the end, really, I felt like I was promised this type of story in those first two episodes, Brother and New Eden, but it was very quickly abandoned. And I kind of felt cheated. I felt like I was teased and then not given the story that I was promised. And this goes back to where we ended in season one, where we had this war arc, this mirror universe arc that was very character drama, very political drama driven. And we were looking forward to getting back to Star Trek in a more episodic format, and Star Trek as the type of science fiction that is the literature of ideas. And we didn't get that at all this season. There are not really any big ideas in this season. It was more character drama, character arcs. And as I said at the top of the show, if that's what you're here for, I think this season really delivered. But it's not what I'm here for. I'm here for the literature of ideas. And so this was a big disappointment for me. And the disappointment was doubled down on because I felt like I got some of it teased and then just didn't get it.
Part of what we've been doing today is looking at what was promised and then where was the drop-off point? Where did we lose what we wanted to happen? And, you know, the character of Pike and Pike's relationship to religion is something that went through the season much longer than other things that we were teased. Really up close to the end, we're getting him talking about destiny and fate. And that's something that, because its drop-off point, you know, didn't seem like it was going to happen, I really felt that it was going to be a big part of the finale. And it wasn't. Its drop-off point was right there at the very end, when kind of it was one of the things that would have been cool to have seen solved.
Yes, I think for us, the real theme of this season actually is drop-off points in some way. And really, we might actually just characterize then our disappointment, our criticisms with this season, as not being that they should have told a different story or that we just didn't like it or like aspects of it. But in fact, the solution to our criticisms is more story, please. Slow it down, more episodes. And a lot of these problems would have been solved. Trying to cram so much into just 14 episodes. They had two or three seasons worth of story here and just tried to shove it into not enough space. So we're getting things that we wanted, elements of Star Trek, elements of science fiction, characters that we're interested in, characters we're invested in, are being sort of nodded at but then not followed through on. So I think that's probably maybe bleeding into speculations and predictions here and making pleas. The things I'm hoping for is a slower pace going into season three. Well, there's just one more thing I want to say about religion before we get into those speculations and predictions and bring the show home. After the episode New Eden, gosh, that feels like a long time ago now. After New Eden, we received a lot of emails from listeners. Really, it was probably close to about 50 emails. Emails about the way that religion was depicted in that episode, and a real sense that the writers of this show are hostile toward religion, and especially to religious people. And I had promised those listeners that we would address this, but I kept waiting for it to come up again. And since it never actually did, since the show really dropped this as a theme, as an issue, we've waited until this wrap-up episode to make good on that promise. I thought New Eden was an interesting episode, and you picked it as your favorite one, Valerie, but it did leave me feeling like our writers dislike religion, even while at the same time, I think it's pretty clear that they have very little experience with or real knowledge of religion, and certainly not religious people. And this is a place, again, I think, where we can talk about representation. About 80% of people around the globe are religious in some way. It's less than that, I guess, in America. But there's very little of that in this show, and what there is pretty wrong. It's pretty ignorant, really. And the religious beliefs of the people on New Eden, the only religious people we really get here, are criticized by our show's protagonist. And that struck me and clearly struck many of our listeners as bigoted in a way that is contrary to the stated goals of Star Trek. And the way that's handled here is that we get the writers trying to tell us a story about the dichotomy between religion and science. But this is a false dichotomy in the real world, right? There certainly are some religious people who are opposed to empirical science or who are hostile to the findings of that empirical science, findings that contradict their cosmological interpretations of scripture. But that's not universally true. It's not a necessary component of religious belief. And it's certainly not ever been a part of my experience growing up in a church community. I mean, even our contemporary biology and physics are actually founded on the discoveries of Christian clerics. Genetics was discovered by a Christian monk, and the Big Bang was discovered by a Christian priest. So there's not any inherent tension between religion and science, and most religious people don't have any type of hostility to science at all. And frankly, if anything, here in this episode, we see the opposite. What we get in this episode is Burnham advocating scientism as a type of belief system that is opposed to, even hostile to, any other cosmology. And she's behaving like a zealot, right? She's the one who is actively shaming people for not sharing her belief system. And she's the one demanding that these people reform themselves. And I certainly felt this way while watching that episode. I did talk about it a little bit when we covered it, but I held some of this in because I was waiting to see where the show was going to go with this, because this could actually have been turned into a really interesting story. This was certainly an important debate in the early 20th century. Brandon and I have talked a lot about the opposing positions of W.E.B. Du Bois and H.G. Wells on this question, a debate they carried out in their own science fiction stories. And I was really hoping that the writers were going in this direction. But again, since they dropped it, we're left with just this one episode in which the writers depict scientism and religion in grossly simplistic terms. And by the end of the season, when I look back on it, what I see is writers in this episode claiming that believing in God is irrational and therefore not a good idea, and then turning around and making jokes about torture, which has left me with a pretty icky feeling. But I know that the writers are capable of better than this. And in fact, this was all handled pretty awesomely in the first season, where we get all sorts of interesting story about Klingon religion that really explored the diversity of belief systems. And that I thought especially emphasized that belief is only one component of religion, that ritual and practice are perhaps even the more important part. And that's actually a pretty sophisticated way for television to be looking at religion. So I was sort of doubly disappointed then by the way it was handled here in this season.
All of this points to, or rather, you know, brings to light and to the surface that the Trek has had a complicated relationship with religion. And a lot of that comes from Roddenberry's original vision. And one episode that is maybe worth pointing out here is the Next Generation season 3 episode, Who Watches the Watchers, that really puts a proto-Vulcan society on the pedestal for having overcome religion almost the way we've overcome the resource problem, etc., and other parts of Trek. So I think one of the points that you're making is that Trek has not always been a welcoming place for people who are religious, and that there were some opportunities to at least have a conversation about it in these two seasons, and that you, Glenn, were personally kind of dissatisfied with how it all went.
Well, I think one of the things people were dissatisfied about was that it's raised here not really as a question for discussion. Or maybe it's better to say it is kind of raised in this episode in New Eden as a question for discussion, and then it's dropped. This is the big refrain for us, I guess, that we didn't know was going to be the refrain for us coming into this episode. Whereas in Who Watches the Watchers, that is actually the question that the show is asking. I think we are meant to be on Picard's side there, but at least it's being posed as a question for us to consider in a meaningful way, in a significant way. And here it's just kind of teased at. But also, I will say people were pretty upset that Burnham was literally just walking into the middle of someone's church service and interrupting it and trashing it and mocking it to the people as they're practicing it. It was a hostility, not just of ideas, but a hostility of action. And I think that's where one of the differences lie. And yes, complicated history is right. Roddenberry himself changes his mind over time. He's much more hostile to religion in early TNG than he was in the original series, where he was neutral about it. He did think that religion is something that has the potential to drive us apart, to be a source of difference between us, and in that way is something that could be overcome. By the time we get to TNG, he does think that it is something that holds us back from being rational people and getting out into space, for example. But then we have Deep Space Nine and even Voyager, but especially Deep Space Nine, which is a show that is largely actually about religion. Bajorans are an extraordinarily religious people. That's their defining characteristic in some way. We spend a lot of time in Bajoran monasteries. The captain character in Deep Space Nine, Sisko, as you brought up already, the Bajorans believe he is a religious figure, a sort of messiah figure. He doesn't believe that because he actually kind of feels the same way Burnham does. And he has an arc about that, where he starts from Burnham's position and then embraces really the Bajoran position and comes to really be a kind of practitioner of the Bajoran religion. That's a simplification of his arc, but it's dealt with in a way that I think was extraordinary for TV, especially in the 90s, but maybe all TV. It might be the most religious TV show that there's been, most religious secular TV show that there's been.
Well, I mean, Battlestar Galactica.
Right. That's also Ronald D. Moore, right? Who's behind all of the religious elements of Deep Space Nine as well. And really, I think all of this points to that, hey, we should probably do a thematic religion and Trek episode at some point. I think that would be a great conversation. And by episode, I mean a series of episodes, because I think as listeners are hearing, I could go on about this for quite a long time. Let's cut it off there. Let's move back to some of the more lighthearted aspects of the show and get into speculations and predictions. I'll move us into the first topic here, which is, hey, Pike show, it's not a question. Look, everybody wants this. It was teased at the end, but I think by now everyone knows it was not an explicitly backdoor pilot. But something I do want to call attention to, listeners who maybe aren't on social media as much as I am, there is a petition going around, and Anson Mount has said, hey, please sign this. This is how we're going to get this show. Alex Kurtzman, the showrunner of all of Trek, the czar of Trek, has also said this is going to help him pitch the show to CBS. So if you haven't already put your name on that, go find that and do that, because I think we all would like to have that show.
And with season two kind of officially behind us, it's time to look to season three. So I'll admit it. I'll be the first one to say it. I am super confused. Who is where and when? So let's try to tackle the question of who's on the ship, which is actually a nice little parallel to the end of season one when we were just shouting, Spock's on that ship.
Right. Who's on that ship is the refrain this season here.
It's not Spock. It's definitively not Spock. Of that, I am sure.
And I'm a little surprised that it wasn't Spock. It's great that we got the loss. We've talked about how important that is for the way we're going to read TOS Spock. So actually, I'm probably glad they made that choice. But I'm actually a little surprised they made that choice, because what's happening here, what's being set up for season three, is that we're jumping 950 years into the future. And I guess we're meant to understand that that's why we don't know about Discovery. That's why we don't see Michael Burnham again. But there's a wrench in that, which is that Georgiou is on the ship. And we know that Georgiou is getting her own spinoff show that's going to be set back in the 2250s, where she's involved in Ash Tyler's Section 31. So Georgiou has to get back to the present somehow, which means also Spock could have been wrapped up in that, getting back to the present. So I guess for me, in some ways, the question is Georgiou going to come back alone? And is Discovery just going to be taking place in the 33rd century now? Or is it going to come back and season four is going to be back in the 2250s. Season four is going to be one day after Spock is making his log entry at the end of this season.
I have no idea how they're going to solve this Georgiou problem. I could make a few guesses based on some of the sloppiness I've seen in season two that, I don't know, Georgiou is selfish and weird and tech savvy, and she maybe just like secretly has a button on her belt that'll just send her right back, or maybe she, you know, she didn't make it through the, I don't know what you call the thing they went through. I guess it was a wormhole, right? It was a wormhole.
Time hole.
Oh God. So maybe she didn't make it through. She falls out halfway through, and I don't know. She rides the squid probe back to the 2250s. I'm not sure. That one is really tough to square, but personally, I want them to stay in the 33rd century because it answers so many questions. How come we've never heard of Burnham? How come we've never heard of Kelpians, right? Like all that kind of stuff. And I'm super, super excited to get a show that takes place in that time. I'm a little nervous because we've seen, the Daniels in Enterprise shows us I think it's the 31st or 32nd century. So we've gotten pretty close to this time, and Seems like a weird place. The libraries are pretty cool there, though, if I remember correctly. There's just a lot of skyscrapers. Seems a little bit like a Blade Runner world, I have to be honest.
Well, we've actually got some public hints about what's to come from Alex Kurtzman. I want to read you something that he said in an interview and get your hot take on it, because I don't think you have seen this, Valerie. Kurtzman said this: "We are jumping 950 years into the future for season 3. We love playing within canon. It's a delight and a privilege. It's fun to explore nooks and crannies of the universe that people haven't fully explored yet. That being said, we felt strongly that we wanted to give ourselves an entirely new energy for season 3 with a whole new set of problems. We're farther than any Trek show has ever gone before. I also had experience working on the J.J. Abrams films where we were stuck with canonical problems. We knew how Kirk had died, and we wondered how we could put him in jeopardy to make it feel real. That's what led us to go with an alternate timeline. Suddenly, we could tell the story in a very unpredictable way. And that's the same thought process that went into jumping 950 years into the future. We're now completely free of canon, and we have a whole new universe to explore." So how do you react to that, Valerie?
Oof. Okay. First of all, I don't like that he claims that, like, he came up with this idea that fans have been screaming since it was announced where in the timeline that this show took place. It was the first thing that was said among my friend group. The first thing I kind of remember reacting to about this show is we wanted a Trek farther in the future. So it's very convenient that he's like, "Oh, I just happened to have this great idea." I would say 90%. Yeah, I'm on board with that. I like that. But I think maybe for different reasons. That's why it's only 90%. I don't want to be free of the quote unquote problem of canon. And I hope that, you know, the canon that does exist continues to be respected even so far out in the future. Like, I think it's a little disrespectful to say, "Oh, we have this problem of this giant thing everybody loves so much." I don't like that part. So I want this quote unquote new energy to season 3, but because I want to see, what are we aspiring to? What are we like? What have we become? What new things can we imagine about the future? And maybe there's a chance for a lot of, you know, every episode is kind of an away mission in a way, and that'll be fun. I'm a little nervous, though, that maybe it's too far in the future. I don't know. Maybe I just, like, I can't, you know, the porridge is too hot or too cold. It's never just right. It might be too far away to really have consequence. To really be of consequence for lessons that we can learn about where we are now and how we can get somewhere else.
I had a similar reaction when I read this. I'm not sure how Alex Kurtzman is unaware that universally people hated that decision that J.J. Abrams made to say, "Well, I've been hired to make a Star Trek movie, but I don't actually like Star Trek that much, and there's no Star Wars movies to make, so I'm going to set this in an alternate universe so I can do whatever I want." We were all real mad about that decision. Kurtzman seems to somehow not know that. It's as if someone is, like, cutting out negative bits of the internet for him. So I don't like the kind of hostility that he has here that you picked up on as well. But let's glom on to the line here that really matters for speculations and predictions, which is, we wanted to give ourselves a whole new set of problems. I suspect that we are going to see a 33rd century that doesn't have a Federation, a 33rd century that is not the optimistic future of Star Trek, that is, in fact, an extremely pessimistic, almost perhaps post-apocalyptic future, and our heroes are going to have to navigate it, which is not the show that you wanted, as I recall us having that conversation for the first time in a great coffee shop over in West Philly several years ago now.
I mean, this is one of the biggest things for me that sets Trek apart from other kinds of science fiction stories. It's a utopia. It's something to aspire to. Politicians are talking about that now. They're saying that they looked at Star Trek growing up and saw a future that we could work towards. The kindest way to say this is, what you just described sounds like such a bummer. But do not mess with that part of Trek for me, please, because... Oof, I don't know if I could handle it.
Well, let's talk about the elephant in the room here, which is the Short Trek episode Calypso, where we see Discovery 1,000 years in the future, where we have the Discovery computer has turned into a sentient AI. It's been abandoned. There are no people on board. There's no crew on board. Even before we got to the finale, I think we were all wondering if that episode Calypso was going to have something to do with the resolution of this season. If Calypso was taking place in a similar alternate future parallel to the one that Dr. Burnham is living in, but either not one where control was victorious, or maybe actually one where control was victorious, but this ship was escaped its attention and was going to be instrumental in defeating it in the future on its own turf somehow. But now that we've actually seen the finale, Valerie, do you think that what we're going to get is related to Calypso in some way? Is Calypso something we're going to see come back? Are we going to have Zora again?
What I wanted to say was, I think we're going to get the prequel to Calypso, because one thing that I remember about Calypso was this idea that, you know, the crew had abandoned ship. But as I am answering you, I realize we've found another Best Plot Hole award because in Calypso, the ship's been abandoned for 1,000 years. So it couldn't have just arrived, you know, 70 years ago and hung out for a while. So I am really not sure at all. Maybe Calypso was part of the alternate future that didn't happen, where Control won.
Yeah, I think that's my reading of it as well. I think Calypso is actually set in its own universe, its own alternate universe, and that's all we've got, or it's still actually the future in some way, but it's not that Discovery gets abandoned in the 33rd century. It's possible they get back, then abandon it again, and then it does sit around dormant, something like that. But this bit with the 1,000 years or so, or 950, or around 1,000 years, does seem a little too coincidental to not be something that the writers are thinking about. Especially since we saw the way that Runaway and the Brightest Star short track episodes did come back in this season. But how it all works out, remains to be seen. But I'm interested.
Yeah, I am very interested in season three. And I guess my hot take is that I don't want Discovery to come back. You know, I want it to be like, we're here. We chose to be here. Let's figure out life here. Comparisons are being, you know, made, like this is just Voyager, but, you know, they're trapped in the future instead of in the Delta Quadrant. But I would like kind of that plot element of everything being driven by a desire to go home, to be instead, it would be actually kind of irresponsible of us to go home because, you know, we saved the whole universe to be here, and we all really actively made that choice instead of just Janeway making it for them. And now what do we do? And now how do we build that life? Because we have gotten so many Trek plots where we try to build a life because we think we're not going to get back somewhere, and then we inevitably do. I would like to see what happens if we don't even have that as a goal. So I'm stoked about it. But I do think I would really like to know who is on the ship. So I want to run through it really quickly. We don't have to go person by person. But Glenn, help me think it out. So we have Burnham and Saru and the entire bridge crew, basically, right?
Right. Then we've got Stamets, who's not in good shape. And I'm concerned that he's not actually coming back. They've certainly written in an out for Anthony Rapp, and I think that's intentional, not to do crit fic on it, but I do suspect that he's expressed some interest in going off and doing something else, working out schedules and so on. But Stamets and Culber are on the ship as well, and Jet Reno is on the ship, right? And so I think there's every indication that she's going to be a main cast member for season three, which is fantastic. That would be great.
Yeah, and then a bunch of medical staff, including Dr. Pollard.
Yeah, Dr. Pollard is there as well. I mean, really, I think that everybody is on the ship, to be honest, right? I think that although I expressed some confusion and maybe some grumpiness about how that information was given to us and presented to us, I think that we're meant to understand that the whole crew is on the ship, except for people who died during the battle. And the big thing is that Jet Reno is on the ship, and that Georgiou is on the ship, and that Spock's not, and Pike's not.
And Nan is.
Oh, yes, right, of course. Nan is also on the ship, and Poe is not, though I thought she might be, because I thought she was getting set up to join our cast as well. Well, I'm looking forward to continuing the speculations on the forum, but we've still got one more thing to do, as always, here on Lower Decks, and that's a cocktail. And this is the cocktail that is meant to represent the entirety of the season. Valerie, what have you made for us?
Oh, just a small amount of pressure. I think that I will say thematically what this drink does for me is it hits a central theme of season two while being bright, fresh, and aspirational as we look towards season three. So that's kind of what I was thinking when I made this drink. I wanted something refreshing. I wanted a clean start, and I wanted a nod to some of our major themes. So I have really leaned into some punny naming for this drink. I would love for listeners to come to the forum and offer alternative titles for this drink. This is the one that I settled on. Glenn already has some opinions about this title, that, you know, improvements he think could be made. But this drink is called It's About Time.
Yeah, you have already shot down my my suggested improvements, but I'm certain that listeners will have better ideas than either of us can come up with. But time, as we've talked about, is a real central theme here, so that's fantastic. And of course, yeah, puns on time. So what have you done with the herb thyme here, Hoagland?
Right. It's About Time is T-H-Y-M-E, in case that was not already clear, because I don't know how to put time, T-I-M-E, into a drink. I did try that with the Red Angel drink recently, but I'm not sure how it worked out. So this drink, the It's About Time, is going to have, surprisingly, a couple of sprigs of fresh thyme in it that you're going to put in the bottom of a cocktail shaker or any kind of glass you can muddle things in. And with those one or two sprigs of fresh thyme, you're going to add a half ounce of lemon juice, freshly squeezed, please, and a half ounce of thyme simple syrup. That's just simple syrup, equal parts water and sugar, heated until the sugar dissolves, with some thyme, some fresh thyme steeped in it, and then strained out. So you're going to have that fresh thyme, the lemon juice, and the thyme simple syrup in the bottom of a glass. You're going to muddle it all together with, you know, the back of a spoon or a proper muddler. And then you're going to add 2 ounces of gin. I like Plymouth gin here, and a half ounce of Saint Germain, which is an elderflower liqueur. And you're going to shake that all up over ice in a cocktail shaker, strain it out into a coupe glass or your glass of choice, and garnish with another sprig of thyme.
And I love that you've slipped some Saint Germain in there too to get that religion theme slipped into this cocktail. Also, that's a nice touch. Also, that's one of the most delicious liquors that's ever been invented.
Yeah, it's so good. You could just drink that and call it, pretend it's About Time, and you're fine. I will say, though, that, you know, Glenn and I have different cocktail visions. His usually are a bit boozier. Mine are a bit more sour. This is something listeners on the forum have also noted. So feel free to play with the amount of lemon juice and the amount of gin and the amount of simple syrup so that you get a ratio that's right for you.
And let us know the results of your experiments. Before we get out of here, we do want to just thank everyone for listening to the show. It means so much to know that people are out there listening to our conversations about Star Trek, conversations that we normally do actually have in a legitimate speakeasy, not just the one we run in the Jefferies tubes. We're glad that you've been along for the ride with us this really crazy season that had so much plot packed into it. Well, I think on that note, that is going to do it for this episode and also this season. It's kind of sad to say. But with your help, we will be back this fall to cover the Picard show, which would be super awesome.
I think the only thing left to do is to just triple, quadruple, reiterate our thanks to you, our listeners, for doing this with us. And until we're back, stay spacey.